Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of the See Me podcast. I'm Finlay, and I'm joined for this introduction today by Dr. Yonan Pringle. Nice to have you here.
Thanks.
So for this episode, we had the honour, really, of hosting Professor Viola Vogel to see me a few months ago. And Viola's quite a big name in the field of mechanobiology, and we'll introduce her properly shortly. So for this episode, Yonan and Emily got a chance to sit down with Viola and chat about her career. As a quick introduction, Yonan, what was it like to chat to Viola? Tell me a wee bit about the interview before we go into it.
Yeah, it was very insightful, quite daunting to be interviewing such a big name in the field of mechanobiology, but our privilege. She had a lot of insightful comments and answers to her questions about how she got into this field of mechanobiology and where she thinks it's going over the next couple of years.
I mean, I really enjoyed listening to this interview. You really get a sense, I guess, of where a lot of the technology in the field of mechanobiology is, how it's changed. So maybe what were your key takeaways from the chat, or is there anything that stuck in your mind after the interview?
No, I thought it was really interesting how she was talking about the early days of the sort of like field and how this field was growing and how key techniques in the field of mechanobiology, such as AFM, they really just weren't readily available like they are today to a lot of research groups. So it was interesting to hear how they sort of built upon these arising technologies.
Yeah, no, and it's really nice to hear. I think Viola gives a good account of some of the history, but also just seeing what we can do now with some of the technology we have is super interesting. So, you know, without further ado, we'll go into the interview. It'd be great if you could just first, though, introduce Professor Viola Vogel and give us a wee bit about her background.
For those of you that may not know, Viola is a professor of the Department of Health Sciences and Technology at ETH Zurich in Switzerland, where she heads the Laboratory of Applied Mechanobiology. Over her expansive career in the field, she has made contributions over the Atlantic in the States, where she was actually the founding director of the Center of Nanotechnology at the University of Washington, prior to moving to establishing her own lab at ETH Zurich. Over her extensive career, she has made pioneering contributions in applied mechanobiology by deciphering nanoscale mechanisms and how mechanical forces switch molecular and cellular functions, and has illustrated how to exploit such information from biomedical and technical applications. I'm really interested, what initially drove you or inspired you to pursue that extensive career in mechanobiology?
When I started my academic career, all these new tools came just not even on the market, but were presented at conferences to pull on molecules, to manipulate. All the AFM, SDM technologies came on the market. And that motivated me early on in 1997 to apply for a grant to create a Center for Nanotechnology at the University of Washington, where I had my faculty position. And on the protein side, everything we knew at that time was learned from textbooks. There we could see the structures of proteins. They were all equilibrium structures. They had no movement, nothing attached to that. And the notion that proteins could be changed in their functionality simply by cells pulling on them did not exist. And so I got really excited when the first AFM group showed how you can pull on proteins and that they have very different mechanical properties also compared to polymers. That's when I got what I would define as molecular mechanobiology. And with that, I tried then to show that you can indeed change the function of proteins. And there, a crucial collaboration got started between our lab and Professor Klaus Schulten's lab at Urbana-Champaign. And he was, at that time, the molecular modeler. And he had all the tools at that time to two large computational infrastructure to do simulations. And when the first AFM studies came out about pulling a molecule called Titan, we then decided to simulate, starting with the equilibrium structures, how forces can distort a protein. And that was the beginning of even understanding if you don't have structural models, you can never explain biology. And the structural models give indications what functionalities could be changed. And we use then these tools, experimental and simulation tools, to for fibronectin, our PET molecule, but also for many other proteins whose structures were known, to illustrate that forces can pull them and stabilize intermediate structured states, and then to design assays to prove that proteins act as mechanochemical switches. And that notion was new. And I think that notion is the underpinning paradigm change between conventional disciplines, conventional biological disciplines, and the then very rapidly growing field of mechanobiology, because intrinsic to mechanobiology is that cells feel forces and they need to have some ways of sensing forces. And those are proteins that change their function when squeezed, stretched, or embedded in a membrane, feel membrane tensional changes, and then open up to allow for ions to enter the cell.
It's wonderful to hear, because you know, that was still almost now 30 years ago or so. And it kind of leads on to that thought of what's something that you are aiming for that's coming up within the next kind of 10 years within the field. Because I know from your talk, we spoke a lot about this molecular mechanobiology. And it's definitely, as you mentioned, something that's almost neglected at the moment and obviously is crucial in native tissue. So is there something that you, a direction you hope that we move towards?
The basis of our understanding how physical forces are sensed today has changed enormously. But we are at a stage where we want to exploit that in some ways for clinical applications. And I think that unifies many of us working in the field of bioengineering today. And if we want to do that, we need to not only understand how single cells in isolation sense and respond to their environment, but we need to understand entire large cell communities, cell niches, and many of you here work on the bone marrow niche, but there are many other niches that are created, for example, in cancerous environments, in fibrotic environments. And many of the tools that we developed in the past to study single cells, they do not work well at the tissue level any longer. And therefore, we cannot assume that everything we understood from single cells can immediately be translated to the tissue level, and that it still works exactly like that, because the cell in a complex environment receives so many different signals from their next surroundings that a cell needs to integrate all that. So if we just try to tune one physical parameter, it might be important for a single cell, but finally, among all the other signals, not play the dominating role any longer. So we need to develop totally new tool sets that parallel the enormous advances made to analyze transcriptomics of cells in the tissue environment. And we need to develop tools to also probe physical factors in a complex, not model system, but in real tissue. Mm. And that is crucial. Mm. And we made this one step by introducing a little peptide probe that allows us to measure the tension now of extracellular matrix fibers at the tissue level. But this is, I feel, only the start to develop more and more probes that can measure maybe also other extracellular, but maybe also intracellular proteins and how much they are tensed in certain environments and how the tension on these molecules is changing with the onset of disease.
Is it okay if I ask something just on that specifically and about the ECM, talking about, you know, like cancer niches on the cancer front? I'm trying to imagine where that perimeter of that environment is, so to speak. For example, does it then mean, do you think that eventually we can assess how tumours in different parts of the body have a different niche surrounding as well, and then tailoring drugs to specific locations for cancer, for example?
So currently, most of the drugs, they target a molecule. And that molecule can be on the extracellular side, it could be on the cell surface, or it could be a molecule that is found inside of the cell, and then the drug certainly needs to somehow make it through the membrane to reach that protein. But we do not have many tools so far to target also the physical state of proteins. And that opens totally new possibilities in a wide range of diseases. However, before we can even think about those applications, we need to even create and establish the attentional landscape of fibers. And how there was nothing known, because there was no probe whether and what type of tissue fibers are under tension. And all we could quantify as engineers were the Young's moduli of tissues altogether, mm-hmm. with the cells included. But we had no information about single fibers. And this is just one little step to creating a physical signature map for healthy organs and diseased organs.
It's exciting.
Yeah.
Just hearing about it, you know, there's so many scales to look at. And I mean, I think it was a bit harsh of us to ask what you think in the next 10 years, because I imagine it's going to take a lot longer. Yeah, it's just fascinating to think. And is that one of the focuses? Because I know you are now involved in a spin-out company. And I'd love to hear about that. And it's something that I think a lot of us are interested in. Not necessarily if a lot of us would do a spin out, but personally, I'm interested to hear. But even just because we all have that kind of aim of some form of distant commercialization anyway, and it's that translation again that's shifting from research to something else with your work, which I guess is everybody's goal.
So after discovering a probe that can measure the tension of extracellular matrix fibers, in our case, fibronectin fibers, we first had to develop that probe, validate it, then try whether or not we can stain tissues with that, whether we have a lot of non-specific adsorption, whether and how this tensional signature is changing upon known manipulations or induced manipulations in order to gain confidence that what we developed works actually at the tissue level. But then between the discovery and us doing all these validation steps, it typically takes 10 years. So if we would have tried from the beginning to start a startup company, we would have been far too early. You need a huge pool of data to then also later on make good logical, take next steps and make good choices in your model systems, in what type of disease do you want to address in order to progress rapidly. And as soon as investors get involved, they have certain set of questions that are very different from the questions that you would hear at science conferences. And it's good to engage with investors early, but not in a way that you oversell too early your technology, because then it might be dead very rapidly. And so there's a certain amount of what you need to deliver first and then get in contact with investors. In my case, I was very lucky. I had a great graduate student who was involved in the invention. And after that, went to industry, to Big Pharma, learned much more about product development, all the type of skills that I never learned in academia, and also understanding how pharma companies are thinking and what are the requirements for them to say a certain idea is interesting for them. And I invited her to come back to the lab, and she then got prepared to start the startup company. And even that phase took 3 more years to ask what kind of animal experiments would be needed. Can we use Switzerland? We have InnoSwiss to get some preliminary data that help us to take the next step. Then she participated in a number of venture competitions. That's also very important to create a network, and not only a network of people that look at your work and your plans, but also that constantly ask you questions. And they challenge her from totally different ways of how I would challenge her coming from a scientific background.
Oh, that's really interesting. I was thinking there how you were talking about how you sort of pitch to investors, how they ask different questions to what maybe scientists ask. And it got me thinking about what makes good science communication. In your personal opinion, what are is the key to good scientific communication, not only to a wider scientific community, but also, say, to big pharma companies, to investors, and to the general public?
So how is the human mind made? I think, first of all, if we want to talk about something, we think about all the problems that we are working on, because that's where 80% of our brain capacity is being burned. But finally, whether we present at conferences, whether we write a research proposal, whether we try to talk to the general public or to investors, we always first need to think about our audience. What do they know? What do they not know? How can we make them connect to all the complex issues that we are thinking about? And then to build a story. And in part, we need to find something that they can relate to in order to capture their interest and then pull them into our story. And if we don't think about that intensively, it's very, very difficult to get the attention of the person. And this is a skill that should be learned as early as possible. And if learned, is so highly valuable.
It's so nice to hear from you saying when you've moved to different places with all your different positions, you build new networks and they overlap, and sometimes they don't overlap, but you know it's picking and choosing when is best to use that. And I was wondering what other kind of advice you have for ECRs in that kind of realm of things, of building a network, or again, how then it helped translate for your previous student between having big pharma and understanding them.
First of all, we need to engage in social interactions, whether it's going into the pub or having lunches together or at conferences to meet people, to go out and have meals with them, so that you build a network, you build friends, and then among friends you also share not only all the things that just go wonderful, but you also start sharing, this and this didn't work in my lab. Do you have a solution how that can be solved? Or this and this, I see this and this in my institution. What is your policy? Because with that, you might come back and change some policies. And so creating situations where we can create friendships, and then based on the friendships can have really honest conversations about whatever is on our mind at a given time point, that is so crucial.
Mm. And I suppose that also ties in again with your encouragement of finding different countries to work in and learning new cultures and how that can impact, I suppose, also your work and how you think about things. And as you say, if someone's just changing a policy, maybe that fixes everything you need to solve. And another thing similar to that you mentioned was opportunities and saying no. And that's something that I personally really struggle with. I think a lot of people struggle with that. How do you feel if someone comes up to you and says, no, thank you for the opportunity?
I would probably think that it's a little harsh. But if somebody would say, thank you, the opportunity is really intriguing. In the moment I have, I'm working on this, mm-hmm. then I would see the plate is too full. And then I would accept it much more and might come back to you mm-hmm. half a year later with maybe something else. I feel that some people say no far too early because they don't want to go out of their comfort zone, and that is not good either. And maybe a little more in Europe than in the US, people often don't even create opportunity before deciding where they want to be. So I always feel that our jobs get so specialized, and finding the right job at the right place in the right environment, the chances are so small. And we first need to create opportunities, and then we can choose.
I want to say thank you for joining us, but also if we could ask you a silly question. If you could be represented by one piece of lab equipment, what would it be and why?
Best represented by one piece of equipment. Well, we developed a molecular stretcher, and that molecular stretcher certainly helped us to show that proteins act as mechanochemical switches.
That's great.
That's great. Thank you so much for being a part of this.
Thank you very much.
Very happy.
Thank you.
Great.